This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Good afternoon, I'm Richard Winham. My guest is Rachel Landrum Crumble. Rachel is a poet. She's also a teacher who has, amazingly to me, taught from kindergarten through college level, which, when you stop to think about that, you know, at each level, it's almost like starting over, isn't it?
I guess that's where we get back to that process orientation that I mentioned before we came on air, that I'm very process oriented, and so I can be in the moment with whatever group of learners, I guess. Yeah.
Well, that sounds good, but dealing with children of kindergarten age and dealing with college students, some would say it's exactly the same, but the truth is it isn't, is it?
Right.
Because
no.
Somebody in kindergarten, even though they may behave exactly the same way as people in college, they don't think the same way.
Yeah.
Which do you find more challenging, to teach at college level or to teach at that very young elementary level?
Actually, right now I've been teaching for most of the past 20 years in high school. And that is probably the most challenging because it's talking about the whole person. Oh my gosh, there's so many precious, damaged whole persons that don't feel whole and don't know they can be whole, that I deal with every day, that a lot of the teaching is sort of modeling dignifying behaviors for them and speaking into their lives that, hey, you're valuable, I see you, you know, as well as content. So, and I'm kind of an individualizer, so I teach students, not content, in, you know, according to the student who they are.
I mean, that's the most wonderful gift you can give somebody is to say, I see you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we all need that, don't we? Yeah.
Especially at that age.
Yeah.
Teenagers. Yeah.
So that's really challenging because it was one of those things where I said when I graduated from colleges, I'm never teaching high school with my English degree. And so I taught adjunct in college, and I taught here too for quite a while, and different places in this area at Covenant and Chattanooga State and here, and taught 2 years full time at Cleveland State and 1 year visiting professor at Lee a while back.
As far as your writing, you have been married to my friend Jim.
Yeah.
Jim Crumble, who is, as I've said many times, I just love to listen to him play.
Yeah.
He always seems to be such an intuitive player. No matter who I've watched him play with, and I watched him play in a lot of different situations.
Yeah.
It always feels as if while he's at the center, he never seems to view it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I agree with that insight. Yeah. I appreciate him for those reasons too. Yeah.
You have three children?
Yes.
Two of whom are old enough to live on their own.
Yeah, now three. The caboose left late in life.
Your other
he
son
left
is
at 21.
Oh, your other son's not a teenager anymore.
No, he's not. I do have poems in which he's a teenager a little bit ago, but yeah, he's 21 and living with his 30-year-old brother in Brooklyn, New York now. My 30-year-old is a stylist. So he picks out men's wardrobes for photo shoots and videos. And he was just at the Grammys with Roddy Ricch.
Wow.
Yeah. So he's doing
he's
some
responsible
fun stuff.
For the way these people look, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I hesitate to make any kind of generalizations about your work based on what is effectively a grab bag of your poems that I found in different publications online.
Right, because they're not all online, but yeah, go ahead.
But the impression I have of the ones that I have read is that, well, first of all, obviously your family is very important to you, but they seem to be also what you most write about.
I guess maybe a fourth or a little bit more of my poems end up being about family. I have a lot of love poems.
Some wonderful love
some
poems.
Other ones, yeah.
One that's fairly recent that's not a love poem, at least I wouldn't describe it that way, is called Courage for a New Year. And I love the two lines, in these early hours, starting over, seems possible.
Would you like me to read that one?
Yes, I would. I like to think that way at the beginning of a new year.
And I did. I wrote it on New Year's Eve last year, not this past, but the previous year, because I have a habit of you know, Jim always, my husband always plays gigs on New Year's Eve.
Oh, right. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
And I love to write in the new year. So get that replenishing alone time by just thinking over the whole year and naming everything I can think of that I'm thankful for. And then moving into goals if I get there. But often I don't get there because I have so many things to be thankful for. So it's a great way to start the year. But this is called Courage for a New Year. It was published in the online journal Sheila Nagig this past year. Courage for a New Year. All familiar things are released of connotation. In these early hours, starting over seems possible. A shoe on the step becomes hopeful, loses its dereliction, was going somewhere all along. Paper clutter on a bedroom shelf vibrates with history. Old photos, proof of a hard-won past, forecast an unexpected, cheery present. The blank page is a blizzard, and on dog sled we course our way through blinding brightness. While the year is young, it seems possible to arrive. We cannot lose our way before we find it.
That's a really cool line. I really like that. And it's so true, isn't it? Why do you want to be a teacher?
Because I'm a learner. So it's definitely the love of learning and the love of process and the need to articulate process that is pretty important to the teaching process. So that part of it felt natural. And of course, there's more freedom in that in college than there is in high school, where there are state standards and pacing guides and things like that. But I think that, you know, no learning can happen without respect. So that safe space is super important, especially because there's so many people who are traumatized these days. So many students that, at least at the school where I am, that come from trauma and are in the middle of trauma and can barely wrap their brains around learning because of it for various reasons. And so it's like, well, really, you know, they kind of have to be the subject. And I am able to do that since I'm a co-teacher in the classroom, except for some small classes that I also teach. So I can individualize.
Is one of the reasons for the trauma financial challenges?
There's the county I teach in is a county of poverty, and so there's a lot of attendant social issues with that. The same as urban issues, but more rural, some urban. And so, yeah, you know, as I am I'm a Christian, and so my own the grace that I've received, I give. And you know, I hear students say, and it makes me cringe, like, if you want respect, you gotta give respect. I'm not gonna respect anybody that doesn't respect me. Well, that's so twisted. It's like we each have dignity and worth because God made us. And, you know, who I am is what I'm going to be to somebody. I'm not going to wait and see how they're going to be to me before I act this way to them. But that's just kind of
that's a defense mechanism, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it is. Yeah.
The reason I brought that up is because you wrote a poem called The Poor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't even bring that one, but I'll read it. Yeah. I wrote it.
Because I thought it's a beautiful poem, the way it's expressed.
Yeah. My sort of extended family is New City Fellowship Church, which I've been involved with since I was in college. And it's started out as a ministry to the poor and the black community in Chattanooga. And I wrote this back then. The poor. In the sky, it's raining backwards, always backwards. From where we stand, it is a nightmare. Our tears are the sprinkler system of heaven. The clouds grow lush and green. They tantalize beyond our ability to desire. We stand poor with sand in our shoes and dust in our mouths, holding buckets upside down to catch the rain.
So part of what that poem seems to be saying is that everything's stacked against them.
Right, just that total helplessness and hopelessness.
Something that I'm not sure many of us really understand.
Right. It's just unless
you've truly been, you know, in that place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Poverty of Imagination.
I think this is a love poem. This appears to be addressed to a partner. And at one point, it's called Hold the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
It's divided by Roman numerals, 1 through 4, rather. And this is Roman numeral 2. You are a house without doors. I am a house without walls. It's raining. Open the window and let me in.
Yeah.
But I love that idea of you are a house without doors. I'm a house without walls. It's as it was with that student you were just talking about. You know, I'm not going to respect somebody who doesn't respect me.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a person, a house without doors. There's no way into that person because they've got these.
That's true. Yeah.
This shell all around them.
Yeah. Yeah. And this poem, Hold the Moon, is a love poem, really, to my husband. And you know how opposites attract. And we need certain things from each other. And I, especially at the beginning of our marriage, didn't have boundaries, very, very healthy boundaries. And he was like a walled city. So, yeah. Do you want me to read this?
Please do. Yeah. I love this poem. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. It's called Hold the Moon, and it was in the Stickmin Review a few years ago. You can find it online. Hold the Moon. 1. Waiting through the cold current of your silence, I am waist deep, going deeper as I move towards you. Your skin of night is soft and hot, almost against me, but an ice flow breaks loose, pushes me away. For a moment, I forget to breathe. The cold air, dangerous, jagged in my chest. What a pair we are. You fear intimacy, I fear abandonment. Love, think of the continents our blood has traveled to bring us here. 2. You are a house without doors. I am a house without walls. It is raining. Open the window and let me in. 3. Does my unrequited love for words render you silent? Or does your silence render my love for words unrequited? All I know is when the words come in my torrent of loneliness, you are left looking silly, helpless as any man, desperately clutching an umbrella under a volcano. 4. 6 years ago, I lifted our daughter high under a December night sky until her small heart filled up with words of longing. Oh, hold you, moon. Wordless lexicons opened up inside me, and I felt held in that moment. Is this your language, and will you teach me? Never mind, love, don't speak. Just hold me like that.
This is Talking Writing on Scenic Roots. My guest is Rachel Landrum Crumble, a noted poet, as well as a teacher and a parent.
Another layer for that for me was being raising biracial children. My husband's black in the 80s and 90s here in Chattanooga in the South. And my husband and I are transplanted Yankees. We've lived here longer than anywhere, so it's home to us. But at the same time, we're always aware that we're outsiders. But in a way, I'm really thankful that we raised them here, because what I said to them when they were younger is that, like, evil has a real face. Like, it's not an institution here. It's like somebody calling you the N-word. And it's like, oh, yeah, there it is. But it tends to be more institutionalized in the North and in other places in the country where it's like, you can't quite touch us, but it's like, oh, I know that. That's ugly. Okay, I can deal with the ugly because I can speak back to it and I can remember who I am. And so sort of coming from a place of with our children, and we had this conversation a lot from the time they were really little on up, was you are first ours. Well, first God created you, so you're precious and valuable. Mm-hmm. Then you're ours, though you're precious and valuable. Then you're each one of us, so you're part of me, so you have, and of course, race is a construct, so, but, you know, you can be proud of who you are with me, that you're, you know, you're biracial, you're black and you're white, and different friends of mine even have raised their kids differently with this. But I said, but the culture will look at you and say you're black, and you should embrace that because that's precious. And, you know, talking with them a lot about black history and helping them to embrace that part of who they are, so that they're not like, oh, I'm not that. Yeah, you are, but, and people think only in those binary terms. Not so much today. I think people understand a little bit more about multiracial.
You're around teenagers a lot. And that's my impression too, that this generation seems to be more open-minded than any generation I've seen previously.
I feel like that what's happened is that they've forgotten history, which is even scarier, because I see that they don't know the stories, that they're not, even though they're maybe a generation removed from the stories about how hard won their, you know, certain freedoms are, that they don't know the stories, and so they don't appreciate maybe even their own backgrounds. African-American students, I teach some of them, or what it takes, you know, that why as a white kid shouldn't you use the N-word with a friend just because it's on a rap song? Like, just because if they call each other that, they've won the right to do that. That's for them. It's not for you. And, you know, they don't understand appropriation or any of that.
You've written about this a lot, Rachel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you care to read one of your poems?
Oh.
Sure. Black Friday is one that I'll go ahead and read that. It was in an anthology called Carrying the Branch, Poets in Search of Peace, in 2017. And Emily Dickinson was a poet who in high school I found, and it was like, oh, my gosh, like, she's my my sister from another era. She had the language. She found the language for things. And there's a poem called There's a Certain Slant of Light, Winter Afternoons, that carries like the heft of cathedral tunes, heavenly hurt. It brings us, we can find no scars, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it any. Is the seal despair, imperial affliction sent us from the air. None may... I can't remember the rest of it, all of it. But anyway, I'm taking, like, I have these Roman numeral parts that just take up a portion of some different lines from that poem. It's called Black Friday. One, there's a certain slant of light. Late afternoon squints through the west windows. I am content with leftovers and quiet. My male child accounted for and sleeping safely home. Two, heavenly hurt it gives us. A distant dog barks without conviction. Traffic swooshes steadily 2 blocks away. The last of the gold and scarlet leaves tumble from the trees. Protesters in Chicago carry this message down the magnificent mile. Justice is the public face of love. 16 shots and Laquan McDonald's 17-year-old life folded like a knife. Three, none may teach it any. A ladybug crawls across the screen, unfolds wings, flies off. My synapses still smarting from the 2 a.m. phone call, felony charge, detention hearing. 2 weeks ago, I told my son, be careful who you get in a car with. It could cost you your very life. Four, when it comes, the landscape listens. Today, in Chicago, Paris, and Chattanooga, shadows held their breath, mourning senseless violence. 7 shootings in 3 days in my city alone. The youngest to die in the Paris attacks was 17. My son is just that age today. I exhale. There are reasons why the heart is convalescent.
many reasons if you were to read your other poetry, and it's not as if it comes as news to any of us.
Right.
That the zeitgeist at the moment seems to be so fractured.
Yes.
And fraught.
Yeah.
You know. And you talked about race being a construct. Gender
yeah.
is equally a construct.
Okay.
And you are wrestling with that one all the time. And that also seems to be something that's being challenged. A lot of the assumptions that we had about gender and how you treat people.
Yeah.
For you, Rachel, it's a double whammy, on top of which you have a daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of her parents is black.
Yeah, yeah. And she lives in California, and she says that race rarely comes up because what the brown people treat them like their own, whoever they are, and they own her, and she looks like she could be this or she could be that, and she kind of, you know, but she embraces who she is. As a, you know, when she was at GPS, she helped start a club, a sort of a unity club kind of thing.
Forgive me if this is too personal, but work is personal.
Yeah.
When you met Jim,
mm-hmm.
and you both decided to marry.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of you are naive. You understood.
Right.
When
we were just kind of like buddies hanging out, we went to Cloudland Canyon. I guess we were a little more than buddies, but we weren't like, yeah, we wouldn't have considered that we were dating. We went to Cloudland Canyon and we got run out. Two white guys came up, young white guys, and they wouldn't even look at Jim or address him, which I found so weird. They just looked at me and said, "Mind if I ask you something?" And I said, "What?" And they said, "Ask you to leave." And I'm like, "Why? We're at a state park." In fact, we're sitting there with the Bible open on the picnic table. And I'm like, "Dude, you know, we're not hurting anybody." I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you're here with a black man and he's here with a white woman. And if you were here with a white man and he was here with a black woman, that would be okay, but we don't allow this kind of stuff on our mountain. And two men just went to get shotguns, and you better leave and take the same roads you came by." So we left because there were no rangers or anything around. And I was so upset. And it was funny when I compared notes with my husband later, when he was my husband.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was angry that he was even dating or sort of talking to a white woman again, because he said he would never do that again. So his was like, why am I putting myself in this space again? And me, I was just feeling what that's like for the first time, you know, to feel threatened.
I'm assuming that wasn't the first time that somebody had made some kind of overtures to him like that.
Well,
but was it the first time that he'd had a relationship with a white person?
No. In fact, when he was in college, we would just hang out. I was a student here at UTC, in fact, when we started hanging out. And I was used to hanging out with guys as friends, so it was not a big deal, except that he kept calling me. So I was like, what is this? But we were at Yellow Deli, which is back in town and used to be a long time ago. And he said to me when we were there, "What would your father do if he walked in right now?" And I said, "He'd be fine. He dated a black woman in the 70s after my parents divorced. They lived in Columbia, Maryland, which is fairly progressive, but even then they caught hell for that." So I said, "He'd be fine." I said, "What about yours?" And he said, "He is deathly afraid I'm going to marry a white woman because my two best friends did. But I'm never dating a white woman again because when I did in college, her parents threatened to pull her out of school if she didn't break up with me." And I really wasn't offended because at that point I wasn't romantically attracted to him. I was like, "Oh, okay, you know." So
in other words, at that point,
yeah,
he was saying, you know, there's a line, and I'm not going to cross it. We can be friends,
right?
But I don't want to get any more involved.
And I was fine with that. But then he kept asking. Then one time he was stuttering about asking me out, and I'm like, "Oh, you're really asking me on a date?" And he was like, "I need to talk to you. I've been praying about this." And I'm like, "Ooh." And
what about you? What was your feeling about it?
I tend to kind of process when things are in front of my face in terms of that sort of thing. And I wasn't like attracted to him, but it didn't bother me at all to like hang out with him. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with dating interracially either, but when he said, would you be willing to pursue a dating relationship with me? And he had prayed about it for days and wrestled with it. And me knowing what the cost of that had been for him in the past, I trusted him. And I trusted his walk with God enough to go, okay. And then the feelings came. Yeah. That's kind of how it went. Yeah. But I have another love poem about that, sort of summing up that love relationship. It's called In Praise of Detours, and this was published in the Porterhouse Review last year. In Praise of Detours. At the starting line of my white suburban guilt, I first foresaw a tweedy, liberal, blue blood in my future, a family friend, then, God forbid, a disheveled manic angel. I was on my way to an addiction to unstable men who would disappoint me, fair-haired, blue-eyed progeny, a divorce. But traffic was heavy. I was impatient and took a detour. You were on your way to winning a black trophy wife to please your father, who always disappointed you. You were this quirky drummer with a blowout fro and a laugh and a stutter. You never wanted to date a white woman again, and I didn't care. I thought you were sent on some mission of rescue by a mutual friend. Not sure what you saw, but you couldn't leave me alone. You called me from the phone in my dorm lobby and took your time asking me out. 35 years later, our three children have your heart-shaped face and my smile, conceived in the laughter we share. Tonight, I arrive here knowing I have loved you more than half my life, and that more than this house, you are my home.
Rachel Landrum Crumble, my guest this afternoon on Talking Writing. This is Scenic Roots on WUTC.